This is straight out of Crumpton with your host, Greg Crumpton.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Straight Out of Crumpton. I'm Greg Crumpton, your host for today, and welcoming a gentleman who has been in my sphere for a few years now, I don't know how many, but I lose track because they go so quickly, but a few. And we've met through the industry, a couple of trade shows and all the places all the cool kids hang out. So we are going to get to talk today to Jonathan Henderson, who is an account manager for McKinstry in their technical services division. So welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks, Greg, for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been feels like it's been a couple of years coming to sit down. I know we've talked about doing this and spending some time together, and here we are. So I'm really excited to be here today.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird how, you know, you start talking about these things, and maybe it was at ASHRAE or AHR somewhere, and then next thing you know, we finally get it done. So I'm glad we were able to sync up today. Yeah. So, Jonathan, before we get rolling, I always like to give our guests the opportunity. It's really not a choice. You have to do this, okay? Your only mandatory requirement. Give us a little bit of a story about you and what you're doing and how you came to be where you are at McKinstry and all that good stuff. Love to hear it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think, you know, I think that's going to kind of tie into our message today, talking about relationships, because basically, that's how I got my start in this industry. I mean, you know, I know guys like you, a lot of other folks, we talk a lot about relationships and stewardship and mentorships and apprenticeships and things like that. And like, I'm probably a walking epitome of all of those things combined, you know. I was born in Northern Alaska, and I come from a family of, you know, a lot of smart folks that, you know, had a lot of different roles, engineers and blue collar folks and things like that. And so when we moved down to the lower 48, I lived in the Seattle region. And right out of the gate, I got hired on with the second largest county government in Washington State as a facilities tech. And so, you know, I started out as this young buck and I thought, man, this is going to be easy. Like, all this mechanical equipment, you know, we have 55 buildings, like 4,000 or 5,000 employees, and everything, you know, all the types of mechanical equipment that you'd imagine, from chillers and boilers, pumps and things like that. And so, you know, I came into the industry and I thought this is going to be a breeze because, you know, I'm a smart kid and, you know, I didn't see any problem with that. I remember it was literally the very first day, maybe two, that my lead tech manager took me down to the mechanical plant, which I've never even been in a mechanical plant underground. Things like an acre big down, you know, downstairs. And I mean, it's like straight out of the movies. I mean, it was chillers and boilers and conduit and piping and filled water lines and pumps and, you know, compressors. And I mean, everything was like pandemonium. And
everything we dream about.
Yeah, all the good stuff we love now. But at that moment, I tell you what, I stood there and looked at that stuff and I did not even understand what I was looking at. And I thought, I am in way over my head there. So at that time, I mean, thank God I had an ounce of work ethic, and I had amazing, amazing mentors around me that took me under their wing. And, you know, they taught me all the stuff. And this is back in the old days before, you know, the internet was really a thing. I mean, I carried around a little goofy spiral through, you know, notepad in my back pocket all the time and asked a million questions and went down to the bookstores and bought a bunch of books on everything, electrical and, you know, plumbing and pipe fitting and steam and all of it. And at that time too, we had an education budget. So I spent probably a solid 2 or 3 years just, you know, going back to school and, you know, developing my skill set. And so anyways, I did that. I mean, we're talking like nights and weekends, you know, every week for a couple of years straight. And I had these mentors that basically said, you know, hey, if you can learn this stuff, you're going to get to a point where all these guys are going to retire. You're going to move up the ladder. So yeah, there's a financial incentive for me to do that. But more importantly, it was more of a pride incentive. I wanted to learn how things work. And then after doing that for a few years, I basically, I would say the white van showed up with this guy with candy, and he was a controls guy. And I was, you know, down in the ditches working and doing pipe fitting.
You were hooked then, weren't you?
Oh, I was hooked, yeah. And I mean, I'd come home every, you know, every night with anti-seize all over my arms, and, you know, everything was dirty. And this guy showed up one day and plugged the laptop into our system and sat there in, you know, a pair of khakis and a polo and started writing code in front of me. And I thought, what are you doing over there? It was like the Jetsons, you know? And
so what year would this have been?
This was like 2001.
Okay.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, right at that time, I mean, the industry was making this transition where there's a whole bunch of buildings with pneumatics,
right,
hands-on, and then we're making this transition to more GDC, and I was right in the middle of that. And so back in the day, you know, if you wanted to be a crack controls guy, I mean, you had to learn pipe fitting and, you know, electrical and pneumatics and, you know, steam and refrigeration, all stuff. And so I had an advantage right out of the gate.
I still think that is the best controls guy on the planet is a recovering technician,
right?
Who knows how stuff works, because right, you've seen it a million times. A guy will show up or a girl will show up with a laptop, do some keystrokes and say, mm-hmm, okay, my stuff's working. The red light's on. Yeah, but the pump's not running.
Right.
The red light's on. I'm like, well, I don't care about the red light. The pump's not running.
Yeah.
Finding that harmony of DDC in real life is such a magical place.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't even, you know, what's funny about that, Greg, is that at that time, I didn't even understand that. I didn't understand the big picture. Everything was right in front of me. And I had three really, really, really strong mentors in controls back in those days. But, you know, I call them since, and I'm like, hey, I am today, you know, I'm at this place today because of you guys. Like,
that's awesome.
You guys. And I'm so grateful that, you know, they crossed paths and they helped me. But, you know, all three of them said the same things. And they said, they were all from three different, some of the big threes, you know, Johnson Controls and Honeywell and whatever. And, but they basically said, hey, you know, if you could become 50% of a really good programmer and 50% mechanical, like, you will always be in demand. So just do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I went to school, back to school again, and got degrees and learned how, you know, programming works and things like that. So yeah, like I said, I didn't appreciate it at the time. And then years and years went by. And I remember being on a job site one time. I worked for a big OEM, as a programmer, as a tech. And, at this time, you know, the roles were reversed. Like, by this time, I'm in my, you know, mid-40s. And, you know, we got somebody brand new out of trade school. And we were down in front of a big centrifugal chiller. And they didn't know anything mechanically how that worked. Yeah. And right then and there, I was like, I remember a voice in the back of my head, one of my mentors, saying, you're going to become a unicorn. Guys like you will become unicorn. Like, believe me, it'll happen. And so here we are. So then... about probably 8 years ago, I got offered a role into account management, and just being a natural extrovert, and I talk a lot, here we are. So it's been an amazing journey, and I'm just, it feels really good to be here. And it feels like, you know, only in the last couple of years, probably since we've become friends, I feel like, you know, one of the old Jedis where I have a voice. And I get a lot of calls from techs all over the country asking for career advice, or, you know, questions about this or that, or do I know somebody that can help me, or things like that. And it's just because I'm a relational person, I'm a relationship guy. Like, I love helping other people that way.
Well, I knew you were smart, okay, before you told me all that, but now I know you are. You know what gave it away?
What's that?
When you said you moved from Northern Alaska. So everything else is gravy after you get above zero. So
yeah, sure.
That is a heck of a story. And the cool part that you feel down in your gut, man, when you get a call from somebody that needs help, or maybe they don't even need help. They just want to BS and you make them feel good for a little bit because they know where you've been and you understand where they are. Mm-hmm. What a great thing for our industry, man. People that don't have that yet or haven't gotten there yet, what a great joy they have to look forward to. So much fun.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I would say in the last probably, 4 or 5 years, I feel like our industry has accelerated where people recognize the need for community and recognize the need for help, you know, and asking to make those connections. Like, connection's very powerful. And I think it's evolved over the course of time where, you know, there was a time when you never wanted to ask an outsider, an outlier, like, for help, or you had a question because in some weird way it maybe seemed insignificant or maybe untrained. And now I think we're in the space where the technology has gotten so much more complex, and there's so many different niche markets within, whether it's building automation or mechanical stuff. It's hard to be a specialist, and it's impossible to be an expert at everything. You're not going to do it.
So insightful. That is so true. I was thinking about that very topic. My wife's having some oral surgery, and they got to do a couple of procedures, but they want to do it together by putting her under one time. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. A calls his buddy, Dr. B, and they come together and they develop a plan working together to solve her problem. And I thought, man, how cool is that? And that is kind of like what you're describing our industry is getting, that we can be industry champions and people champions without caring what color jersey you're wearing. You know, it's bigger than that. As we know, there's plenty of work for everybody. Like, there's not enough people to do all the work that's out there. Yeah. So you don't have to walk around in a scarcity mentality. There's an abundance out there. So let's embrace it and do what, I mean, you may do something a lot better than me. So if I've got the contract, why wouldn't I call you and say, dude, come join us on this and let's do this together. You know, let's joint venture it, or you be my sub or vice versa.
Right.
But I love I don't want to say companionship, that sounds weird, but the camaraderie maybe is a better term. But you're so right. It's coming. And I think what's really fun is watching people come back to the industry that have stepped away for a while. We're starting to see that. Mm-hmm. The biggest population of people that are returning to work are people who have already retired. And they're either coming back because they're bored, and they're coming back because they need the money, or a combo. And in most cases, the combo. But sure. Man, what a great thing for people to have that mentor mentality. Because I'm like you, man. I know so many people that I can just rattle off like that. That I remember little things, like I couldn't get a piece of equipment to run, and I was at wit's end, and I called this dude, Dan, and I'm like, man, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. And he was, I don't know, a handful of miles away. He drove over. That day, I learned about a lockout relay, and I've never forgotten it, you know, because he took time to explain it in second-year apprentice terms.
Right.
And you just don't forget those learning moments. And to your point, to be able to give those back to somebody else is just so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just think, you know, there's a value that exists when, you know, one of the things that I coach a lot of my, you know, my friends and, you know, different people in the industry with is that, you know, make time for people, make time to teach and educate. And you'll find that, you know, a lot of times you'll have, people reach out to you that they're going to give you nothing in return. Right.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to have a friendship there, and there's going to be a loyalty and camaraderie.
Yeah.
And this industry, I think, is so small that your paths will most certainly cross again. I mean, it's
absolutely
impossible to, I mean, you know, you walk down, you know, ASHRAE or whatever, and there's people that you've probably known for the last, guys like you've probably known for 25 years plus, and they've worked for a million different companies, and it's a very interesting industry that way.
Which makes, you know, I don't know if our industry is unique like that. Probably not. When you get right down to it, maybe some oral surgeons have the same kind of camaraderie. I don't know, but
ours is just better. No, ours is just better.
Yeah, exactly. HVAC. Who wouldn't want to be in that? But my company Service Logic email got hacked, and luckily we have a policy where it'll only send out 200 of whatever at one time without somebody saying, "Whoa, what are you doing?" And so I was talking to our CEO about it. And he said, "You know how many contacts you have in your account or in your phone?" I'm like, "I haven't looked at it lately." He's like, 7,000. And but those have all been aggregated over the last 40 years.
Right.
Of those people that we're talking about, people that if I get stuck in a ditch in Iowa, I got somebody to call. I got a friend out there, you know.
Yeah.
Or if they're having a problem and they want to ask me a question mechanically, or if their grandma's passed away, whatever. You just, it's just about the people. And you and I were talking a little bit before, luckily I remember to hit record today, but unlike my Brainiac move last week where I was 6 minutes late, but we were talking a little bit about the history of McKinstry where you're working. And, you know, that goes directly to what we were talking about, the people. And, you know, I had the fortunate encounter to meet the founder, or I guess the president of McKinstry at the time, in the, it had to be 1990, somewhere around there. And I remember, you know, Mr. Allen, the dad, Bob Allen, giving me 40 minutes of his time when I was a young project manager. And I've never forgotten that. You know, here's a guy who was already super successful then. And you remember the one thing I remember most about that meeting with him? We were talking about growing a service department. And at the time, McKinstry took the lead, and every truck y'all had, whether it was service, installation, or controls, all got labeled service. And that's how they branded that McKinstry service into people's head, because you couldn't see McKinstry without the word service associated with it. I remember that for some reason.
Yeah.
Apparently it worked. He seems to have done okay with that method.
No, it's interesting. They were just talking about those vans a couple of weeks ago at a meeting that I was in, and they said that, I forget what year it was, but it's a long time ago. But, you know, every
it wasn't that long ago. All right.
Yeah, I mean, everybody had this service van where at one time where it had the name of your company and then your phone number, right?
Yeah.
And they said, hey, like, take those phone numbers off those vans. Like, we don't want a phone number on. And literally, you know, the managers were like, are you out of your mind? Like, why would we take our phone number off? And basically their idea was, they said, because everybody knows what our vans are. Like, they know what we look like.
Yeah.
They're white and blue vans. So take those numbers off, you know? And it never once affected business at all.
Well, you know, now that you said that, there may have been a tick of the internet was fresh and they wanted people to go online also, if I recall, may have been part of that decision to go away from the phone, where people did search.
Sure. Right. Yeah, very probably. Yeah, it's just really interesting, you know, because I think one of the things that, you know, folks like Dean Allen, a lot of the managers that I've run into here at McKinstry, you know, one of the words they use a lot, the terms they use a lot, is servant leadership.
Yeah.
And that is a powerful testimony that they have there with folks that, you know, there's managers here in my own office that I look at and I think, you know, they have the same stories that I have, same stories that you have, the same kind of background where, you know, these relationships matter and the upbringing and all that stuff matters. And I'm just really impressed. I'm really impressed. And I think, you know, when you have that mindset, you can spot it instantly in other people.
You know, I've often had conversations with people about what it was, but you know what it looks like and sounds like, and you can't necessarily say what it is, mm-hmm. but it is there. And it's hard to hire for, it's hard to teach, it's hard to demonstrate, but people who have it, and they know what it looks like. So,
yeah.
And to build a company on that is awesome. To be, you know, when I knew of McKinstry back in the day, it was Seattle only. Mm-hmm. And now you're in Dallas and, you know, got North Carolina operations and everything else.
Yeah.
Did the relationships grow that company? The customer relationships made your company expand? Is that what drove it?
Yeah, I believe so. I think, you know, we need to use that word it, like, what is it? I think that ties into that because I don't think there's one definition of it, right? I think there's right. like, what's it for me is probably different than that definition for you. And I was talking to a friend of mine in our industry, different company, but we were chatting about it the other day. And I said that to me, some of the most successful companies in our industry are ones that they don't have a defined box that they try to squeeze everybody into. They don't actually want those types of people. You know, you have to have some structure. You have to have a foundation, but it's like building a successful baseball team or sports team. You're looking for position players that are very creative and solution oriented people that you just want them to say, hey, like, be creative, find solutions, and, you know, bring your relationships and, you know, bring your powers, those superpowers to us. And then that will grow the business organically. And I think there's a lot of companies, McKinstry is one of them. There's a lot of other companies out there that are even some big, huge OEMs that we know of in the industry that have kind of defied the normal status quo and have embraced that. And they continue to do it. And that's why they're growing and a lot of these other companies are suffering.
Do you think that that is because of the demographic of the leadership? Is that an evolving mentality based on the age of the leadership teams, or is that a culture that permeates all demographic?
I think it's a cultural fit because, you know, you look at, like, for instance, like where I work, some of the managers are older, but you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know. I mean, this is a very more modern, progressive take on how you organize people and how you work with people. And so I don't know how that math pencils out across the board. The only data I would have is just, you know, just evidence that I see where I see a lot of companies that, you know, there seems to be, like I said, you recognize it, you know, you recognize that there's this mindset that exists. And I can spot it a mile away. Right?
Yeah.
There's companies that have it, and there's companies I'm like, they're just not on board with that, and they want everybody to squeeze into the box.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's culture more so than age, because I've seen some young folks who get stuck in a really old way of thinking because somebody showed them that, and
absolutely
didn't give them the room to exercise.
Yeah, and I think our industry as a whole has perpetuated that.
No doubt.
I think one of the things, and I mean, there's a lot of different talk tracks we could go down, but, you know, one of the discussions I've had with a lot of colleagues is that, you know, and I don't know, like, I couldn't put my finger on a calendar and say it happened here, but I'm just going to probably say 7 years ago-ish, right around there. I feel like, you know, our industry was kind of moving along in this general direction very quickly. But I feel like we come to this line of delineation where we went two separate ways, the whole industry, where mindset A was like, hey, we've always done it this way. We don't want to change. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And this new technology stuff is like, we're not going to do it until we have to do it.
Yeah.
Right. And then the other line in the sand, you know, the other direction was is that you had people, and this wasn't age related, this was just a cultural, you know, cultural phenomena where you had folks saying, like, hey, this is something new and innovative, and maybe this will make our lives easier. Maybe it's better for X reasons, X, Y, Z, and we're going to learn about it, embrace it, and take it on. And it was really a very divisive, it was a very divisive shift, because if you worked for one of those companies, I mean, you were indoctrinated, like, you don't want to do that, we're going to do this. And it was really like there was no going back. I mean, the crossover was really, really hard. And I think it was really interesting. I felt lucky enough to work for a company at that time where when that line in the sand got drawn, we had the company I worked for had a little open mind about it, the new technologies and things like that. And I'm just a naturally curious person. Like, I always tell people, like, don't ever lose your curiosity. Stay curious.
Yeah.
Like, stay curious. And don't ever think you know it all. Keep learning, because I wanted to learn more about that stuff. I was curious about it. And then, you know, just like I have a lot of folks on LinkedIn all over the country that, you know, I keep in track with, and, you know, we talk all the time. But they basically made the shift, like, hey, we're all going to learn more about this. And we did. And those companies are thriving now. And a lot of even like the more long-term companies that have been around for a long, long time, they're making that shift too. Like, you see it happening. And I'm not saying, you know,
like wave two.
Yeah, politics aside, I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm just saying that they've maintained that curiosity level for the betterment of the industry. And I think when you have, you know, an industry that's so innovative like ours, with so much potential, with so much like incoming people day in and day out that are new to the industry, we have to keep feeding them just crazy ideas to keep growing. Otherwise, we're just going to turn into some stagnant industry.
Well, that's well said, Jonathan. And I think when you talk about that 7 or 8 years ago, part of that to me was when people started to realize we really have a technician shortage. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do something different, we're going to keep looking like we look. And I'm not saying that was the only, you know, driving force behind it, because I do think curiosity, I think technology, I think, you know, advancements in the equipment we service, I think all of that was a part of it. But I really do think that this, I almost said something bad. The crowd that got it early, I think, saw, okay, we've got to get ahead of this as quickly as we can, because if I can have a guy in a pair of khakis and a polo that can plug into a building remotely, mm-hmm. I don't have to drive that guy over there necessarily.
Right.
And I think the quicker that we embraced technology, those companies leapfrogged a lot of the other companies, for a multitude of reasons. But I do think the labor shortage affected that thinking to a degree.
Yeah, I agree.
But it that's just the beginning, you know. Here's my little dog's head that poked up there. but I really love to see companies that I'm an early adopter personally. You know, I'll try anything out, new camera, new phone, whatever. Mm-hmm. Just to see if it's helpful or not. I've got a whole box full of junk over there that I've tried and I didn't care for it. You know, I don't know what to do with it at this point, but I think you have to run your companies that way. Also, you got to try it, you know. We tried some electric trucks recently, the last few years. And lo and behold, now we have a mandate in California that 10% of our fleet has to be electric.
Right.
Well, we already knew what worked because we've been playing with it over here in the sandbox. So mm-hmm. I think that, you know, and obviously we got a big footprint, so we're fortunate to get to do stuff like that. But It's because people said, yeah, let's do that. Let's give it a go and see if it works. Well, we know the benefits and we know the challenges.
Right.
So now we can go implement that in California, knowing what we already know without having to go learn on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's just open-minded thinking. And I think households and schools and businesses and all run better. If you can say, I don't know, to your point, stay curious and let's dig in.
Yeah, for sure.
What interests you these days?
Well, as far as work or just away from work?
Anything.
Yeah, I would say I'm an improvement junkie. That's what I like to do. I think it's part of that curiosity. I like, a lot of the things that I do basically with, with work, I spend a lot of time, working with the team, meeting new customers and learning from them. But personally, I'm a gym guy every day, and I like to do that. And I like to keep up with my health, and I'm a big cook. I like to cook a lot, so.
Well, the gym helps offset that, right?
Yeah, and I'm a pretty funny eater when it comes to picking out, healthy things, and I like to do that too. So, yeah, I mean that's some of the stuff that I like to do that occupy and takes my mind off work from time to time.
So you're in Dallas, where you said today it's going to be rather warm. What is your daily account management? What do you do? What do you sell? Controls, HVAC, all the above. What do you do down there?
Yeah, basically what I do. So we have two different divisions within my branch. We have energy services and technical services. And so I would say technical services, we're kind of the consultant side of the industry, consultant side of the business. So primarily I work with MUSH markets, municipalities, school districts, healthcare, K-12, stuff like that. And a lot of times, I'm meeting with customers and they're trying to figure out what is their strategic vision for the future. That could be, and that could range from a lot of things. It could be sometimes their strategic vision is very narrow because they're saying, well, I have 10 schools and they need new rooftop or whatever. That's as far as their vision goes, which maybe is only like a two or three year vision.
Right.
I just met with a client last week that says we actually have a 100-year vision.
Wow.
100-year vision. And I'm like, wow, okay. So what does that look like? And they said, well, we want to be as energy independent from the grid as possible. That's what we want to do. So, but we don't know how to get there. So my role is basically I sit down with a customer like that, and we kind of have like an internal think tank almost, where we sit around and provide solutions and come up with like creative ideas, funding opportunities, different things like that, to come up with creative solutions to help them achieve that goal. And then we benchmark. So, hey, like years, 0 to 2 or 3, this is a good goal. Years 3 through 5, and so on. So, that's initially, kind of at the outset what I do. And then like long-term, it's just further developing those client relationships and building trust and helping them come up with solutions and then articulating those ideas to their managers and to the public sometimes. So,
you don't hear much about 100-year plans.
First time I ever heard of that.
Outside of the Japanese culture.
Right.
They really, so I study Kaizen. You
I
see
saw that.
That too. And part of the Kaizen is develop, tweak, model, learn, understand, redo. So you're continuously getting better.
Yeah.
But through my study of Kaizen, I've learned a lot about the Japanese culture, and man, it's really steeped, rich with long-term visions.
Yeah.
I mean, hell, we can't get out of our own way next week what we're going to do here as a country, and these countries have long-term visions. I think it's remarkable. And whether they're right or not doesn't matter. I think the beauty is in the preparation, because if you're prepared. A waiter yesterday at lunch, my wife and I went to lunch after church. I always thought this was funny when he said it. And my wife said something about, Can you bring me a straw when you get ready or something like that? And he said, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. And he whips a straw out of his vest pocket.
I like it.
And to me, that's so true. Like, if you have a long-term vision, to be a banker or whatever you want to be as a company, or to be off the grid as far as you can be, whatever happens, then you can adapt to it, because at least you're started down that road.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think, when you go out and say, I have a vision that's a long ways off, even if it's 25 years off, 30 years off, right? That shows a significant commitment in your ideology. Like, hey, I'm committed, I'm all in. It's like finding a marriage move, right? Like, you don't say, hey, my long-term vision is to be married with a family and children, right? And then, be afraid of that commitment. That doesn't work. So, I think in business and strategy, it's the same mindset where, you kind of have to put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
And
to put it out in public.
And out in public, absolutely.
My friend Jeffrey Gittimer always says, do you want your wife to be committed or satisfied?
Yeah, hopefully both, right?
That guy's a nut, but he keeps me laughing. Now, I think, I was going to ask you about some of these green initiatives, and you guys probably work for some municipalities that have visions of getting off the grid or being carbon neutral or what have you. I don't really care what year anybody says they're going to do something, but to your point of making a statement and working towards it, I don't care if it's we're going to have horse-drawn carriages by the year 2031. Mm-hmm. If that's your deal and that's what you're willing to work towards, and you don't just buy trees in the rainforest and not change your operating practice, then I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. I don't care for people whose mission is to be carbon free. And I'm not trying to say anything activist wise. That's their choice, what they want to do. I'm just saying, if you're going to do something like that and make a statement, then you've got to change some of your operations. You can't just throw money at it and buy more trees to offset it. To me, I mean, because it's, I don't believe it's genuine. If you're looking for that arbor credit.
Yeah, there's a lot of industries right now that are under fire that they call it greenwashing,
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's, it's interesting. We, McKinstry, there's different parts in the country where it's very driven, very focused on how to save energy. And there's definite, plans that are pretty much locked in stone and benchmarks that they're trying to achieve. And to me, that's just part of the whole curiosity is that we have a culture here, and we grow that culture to always say yes, no matter what the project is, because we'll figure it out.
Figure out a solution, right?
Figure out a solution. And when we hire people, I think we're, and like I said, that's going back to the industry. I think that's what separates a lot of successful companies from the losers. That they're looking for people that aren't afraid to put themselves out there, even if you fail along the way, which you will.
Right? Absolutely. If you do enough stuff.
Yeah. And but that's progress if they move forward.
Now, I love what you said, because I believe in figuring out a way to say yes more than you have to say no.
Yeah.
And some people aren't willing to do it because what they do is easy enough for them to do, and it's been modified or it's been streamlined to the point where it's just cookie cutter.
Yeah,
that's fine if that's what you want to do, but it's not stimulating to me.
Yeah, and I think that's where you break down, like, in our industry and a lot of other industries, but ours in particular, is that you're either selling a vision or you're selling a commodity. Mm-hmm. And when you commoditize yourself, I mean, you're just basically selling a price. Like, And there's a little bit of wiggle room maybe for, you know, negotiation with pricing. But at the end of the day, it's not innovative and you're easily replaceable.
100 sheets of notebook paper cost this much.
Right.
And that's what it is.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, if somebody, if you sat down in front of somebody and says, we don't need notebook paper, we're going to come up with something totally different.
Right.
Like, let's sit down and hash out a vision for what that looks like.
Well, that was a cool part to me about Henry Ford. And, you know, the competition was faster horses, and his was get rid of the horses. I love that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd love to know your thoughts on nuclear power and especially small modular reactors. Have you had any, have you been dabbling into that with your brain any like I have?
I've been following it. Yeah, I study it. It's really interesting. I think, you know, I'm in that age where I grew up remembering like Chernobyl and, you know, watching old stuff and Fremont Island, you know, videos and, you know, Fukushima and things like that. And I think we're at this tipping point where, you know, if we're going to make the move to electrification, I think people have realized we have to do something other than
just wind and solar.
Yeah. And so, you know, my parents lived down in Arizona, and just east of Phoenix, they have a large nuclear site down there called Palo Verde. And their energy rates, I mean, all of air, like right today, probably 120 degrees there, you know, in Arizona today. That whole valley is scorching hot, but their energy rates are very, very reasonable. It's very inexpensive. And they've been running that for a long time. So, you know, I think as a nation and a lot of other countries, you know, you look at places like France, different countries, they've already made the move to nuclear. And I think we're going to be making that move too. And I think as things get more innovative, you're going to see smaller modular units that are safer and also, you know, equally powerful for, especially like for the data center market. I think data centers take up so much power. And typically, you know, traditionally they build, if you look at where the data centers for some of the, you know, the big companies are located, that's typically where they have, people always think it's because their land, they get cheap land. That's part of it. But typically it's where there's reliable power.
And it's and cables just big around on the pole, you know.
Right. Or they have like hydroelectric nearby or nuclear nearby, something like that. So, so I think as time goes on and there's more of a demand, because we're making a shift towards more technology, we're not going backwards, we're going forwards. We're going to have to figure out ways to keep, you know, the lights on, keep more power cooking. And that's got to be, I think we have to have all the options on the table.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think that there's a right or a wrong. I think there's just got to be an and to the equation. I was at 7x24 recently down in Florida, and there was a really good conversation on our power consumption. And you know, you're like me and everybody else. AI is all you hear about anymore in the data center world right now, which is all cool. I love it. But it's a freaking power hog.
Right.
And one of the speakers, I can't recall offhand who it was, said that in the next 36 months, we will use more electricity in the data center than we have from now ever backward.
I believe
you think about that.
Yeah, I completely believe that. I'm just trying to find this post here on my LinkedIn here real quick. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, so there was a couple of weeks ago on my LinkedIn profile, I posted a post that I thought was really interesting. But basically, you know, two of our, I won't name them, but two of our largest data companies in the United States, their electricity consumption surpasses the power usage of over 100 countries.
Yeah.
In that's, the world.
And that's not going down.
No, we're
crunching more data this hour than we did last hour. So
I mean, it's just that's not going anywhere. I mean, and they keep building, you know, every, as you know, you follow this stuff too, but I mean, every week it seems like there's more and more and more data centers that are going to get built. So, and this is data center, right? let alone if we decide to electrify all of our vehicles and things like that. So.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch, for sure. 100 years from now, we'll see how good of a plan you helped your customer with, by the way. We'll be watching you.
Exactly.
Now, I love to get different people's perspective on it. You know, I've got a good friend. He's an old school electrical design engineer and designed a lot of data centers for a lot of high profile companies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, how in the world do you think you bunch of morons are going to have a nuclear reactor sitting anywhere near a data center when you can't keep water off the darn floor? And I'm like, oh, good point. So he is like my divinity rod for BS, because he's not scared to call people out on their, but I'm also reminded that the technology has come so far from where it was when those accidents that you named happened. The technology's different. So I'm excited to see it happen. I'm all for wind and solar and bio and everything else we can do.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you got to have something that works 24/7 reliably.
Sure.
I think everything else is a good supplement, but
yeah,
interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So what's on your horizon? What do you want to learn next? This is your hardest question too, by the way, because we're getting towards the end of the hour and I want to give you a chance here to weasel out. So.
Yeah, no, that's good. I appreciate it. You know, it's interesting. I was just talking to a colleague this morning. We're talking about different roles and different strengths and weaknesses that we share. You know, we chat every Monday morning. And, you know, I always feel like there's always more to learn, but I think I'm at the place now where it's just more fine-tuning, you know, that people, those people skills, you know, the interactions. You know, I feel like I have a pretty wide net cast of colleagues and contact and things like that throughout the country and even other countries that people like reach out to all the time. I think it's just leveraging those relationships and growing myself as much as I can, like learning from those people. So, you know, that's
a heck of a good goal. It really is.
It really is. I think, you know, I've always said, like, you know, sometimes it's like buildings, right? That's one of the comments I make a lot is that, you know, you can have a very efficient building, but it's very uncomfortable.
Right? Yeah.
And like, I think the same thing is with, it's the same with people. Like, you can be very, very intelligent at your job. You can be really good at what you do, but people think you're a jerk or people think pussy or whatever. And I'd rather be, you know, that resource that I had growing up. But people go, man, you know, when I have a question, like, this guy can help me. And he's not, no strings attached, right?
He's willing to help me.
Yeah, he's willing to help me, you know, a good guy. And if I can help people, then great. Happy to, you know. And I think it's just, you know, further developing those leadership skills. That's kind of the track I'm on right now. And
I love that, man.
That kind of transcends work. I mean, it transcends, you know, a lot
that's
of
life's things. Work, you know,
life's work. And it can be, you know, family, spiritual things that, you know, help develop you in that sense.
Absolutely.
That's kind of the place I'm at right now.
Well, man, I'm proud for you. That's a great place to be. It's been fun watching your career develop over the few years and, you definitely seem to be, I think you have it, Jonathan, by the way. So.
I appreciate it, Greg. That's a big compliment.
Whatever it is, you definitely have it. But
thank you.
I really appreciate you taking time with us today and sharing some of your insights. And it's just fun when you get to talk to people because, you know, like when I see you at a trade show, you're hustling. You know, you're either going here or going there, or I'm going here or going there. You just don't. We don't, that's not fair. We don't take time to sit and talk because we think we're so darn busy. So thanks just for
Zoom. I still remember what you were wearing our last time I met you, man. You had that nice blue suit on with those nice shoes, and I think you had some fancy socks on. I was like, dude, this guy is styling.
Man, you know what? I love that suit.
I loved it. Looks like $1 million on that thing.
It seems like the politicians have taken my color and really gone wild with it, because I see a lot of them wearing that blue. But
they look good. They look
that's
good.
Funny. Funny you remember that. But I do appreciate you taking time. As hot as it is in Dallas, Texas, taking a few minutes inside in the air conditioning with us today. But
yes, sir.
Well,
thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you did. And folks, I hope y'all enjoy getting to know a little bit about Jonathan Henderson. He is an account manager at McKinstry in their technical services division, but just a heck of a good guy too. An industry guy, family guy, trying to do the right stuff. Just good stuff. Good to have him. Tell us where people can follow you. Where LinkedIn, or what are you, Instagram, or what are you?
I'm just a straight up LinkedIn guy. Yep. So I have a profile under Jonathan Henderson on LinkedIn. And if you connect with me, I will connect with you. So
you're the good looking one, right? And the Jonathan Henderson.
I hope so.
Well, everyone, thank you all for taking time out of your day or evening, or whenever you had a chance to listen to this podcast. Straight Out of Crumpton is available on Apple, Spotify, all the cool places. And you can go to gregcrumpton.com. There is a podcast tab on there as well. I think we're running, I don't know, 120 something episodes. So there's a little bit something for everybody. We try to keep it in, lit up with fun stuff, a little bit of insightful stuff, and just try to have smart people who have it on this show. And today was a success. So, Jonathan, thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Yes,
somewhere.
Sir.
I don't know where we'll see each other, but we will, because we always do. And until then, we'll talk to you later. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Greg. Have a great day today.
You too, bye.